So I'm Kitty Feldy, and I have known Christine Avila for a million years, at least it seems like that. And this conversation will be a little about art, a little about dance, and a little about history, and who knows where else we'll go. But, I mean, let's start at the very beginning. So we kind of had a rom-com's cute meet at the very beginning. Tell us about that.
I think I was driving down Vine Street, and this crazy person opened their car door without even looking into my pathway. I had to swerve into the middle lane. I was really angry, and I've never done this before since. I pulled over, got out of the car, and went up just to say to that person, "Are you nuts? Do you just don't know that I have the right of way, blah, blah, blah?" And it was Kitty Feldy.
Well, and I think the purpose of your driving up Vine was because we were working on an early script of mine about how the Dodgers moved to Los Angeles, but told from LA's point of view. And a great part of that story was all about Chavez Ravine.
My dad used to do house calls there.
Well, and wait a minute. We bought it back up. Your dad was a doctor.
He was a physician and surgeon. His area was OBGYN. But when he became a doctor, you just did everything. I mean, he did splinting. He did brain surgery. You just did everything. So he would get house calls, and one time we drove with him, and my aunt said, "Stop the car." She jumped out and cut some nopales, some really good cactus that she hadn't seen since she was in Mexico, and then came home with them and cooked them for dinner that day.
So it was extremely appropriate that you were the character who sings the song about Los Angeles in this play about the changing neighborhood of Chavez Ravine.
Yes, it was a wonderful play, and I was delighted to be asked because I had, as I said, a little bit of experience driving through that area that was like walking into another country. There were no sidewalks. It was like being in the middle of some kind of forest or some other area that was right in the middle of Los Angeles. It was like my dad had an office at 6th and Broadway downtown, and he could get there in 10 minutes, you know? And it was just a different community of people. So I was really delighted to be asked to work on a play about this particular part scene in Los Angeles, what year was it?
I think it was the 80s, and you had the most magnificent, you know, it's like the 11 o'clock number in many ways. It was a very difficult but beautiful song. Talk about that.
Well, it did come in the middle of the play somewhere, and it wasn't like a musical, so it was a whole different texture from everything else. And the song was it called Palo Verde, I think, or it was about...
I think This Is My Home.
This Is My Home, that's it. And it was about a woman who was describing her homeland and in comparison to this very strange land that she was having to get familiar with and now call her home. So it was, you know, the story again of the Mexican immigrant or Latino immigrant coming to Los Angeles and trying to make a new start because there was no choice but to leave home because of the various problems there, civil war, unrest, you name it, economic. I mean, it's the same thing that we're seeing now from people who are leaving Africa and crossing the Atlantic Ocean and then coming up north to the Los Angeles, to Southern California area, to our borders. You know, when I look at as I have because of the PAL Legacy Invitation, I've been looking at many, many of the plays that I'm in, and I'm so... fortunate to have been part of another generation wave of playwrights and musicians to talk about the situation, the diaspora, if you will, of Los Angeles. And the plays include, you know, Zoot Suit, as well as plays from South Coast Repertory, as well as projects up at the Sundance Institute, which was, of course, an instrument to invite new playwrights and give them a place to hear their voice with really good actors. And so I've been very fortunate.
Well, let's turn back the clock, because Los Angeles as an arts community has changed in our lifetime so very much. I go back to 1984, which was when the Olympics were last here, and they had created this international arts festival that us as locals were able to participate in as well. What were you doing?
Well, I had a couple of different options. One was a play, a monologue about the life of Kiko Bejines, who was a middleweight or maybe lightweight fighter. And it was the story of his life from his sister. He suffered a bad hit in the ring and died as a consequence. But I ended up doing another play called Agamemnon, written by Stephen Berkoff, and got to do two roles. One was Cassandra, and one was Helen. Helen didn't have many lines. It was really a walk across the stage, but I don't care. But it was really an extraordinary piece of writing done in verse. It was like a verse poem from top to bottom. And, you know, it was a really terrific part, and I got to work with Stephen, who is an extraordinary writer, director, as well as actor. It was first performed at the Pilot Theater on, I think it's Melrose, and then we moved to the Little Theater at UCLA. So I got to go back to my alma mater and do it on the Little Theater there on a beautiful set and a beautiful stage and, you know, a wonderful backstage area. And it was a really lovely cast, so I was really delighted to work on that.
Well, you know, you mentioned UCLA. Tell me what the theater department and the culture was like then. I came out of UC Irvine, which had a strong theater department, but, you know, it was like a little brother to UCLA.
Well, when I entered UCLA, which was 1965, the film department was really a trailer or two, and the theater department was had a brand new, beautiful theater with computerized, if you will, lighting access, which was amazing. Nobody had heard of that. And there was the big theater and the little theater. And there was interest in new playwrights, of course. The first year I was at UCLA was on the semester system. The second year, it was the quarter system. So, of course, I lost units. And then by the third year, you know, you're just trying to finish and move on. But there were a lot of interesting new plays. And what was funny at the time was that I was interested in musical theater. And there was one little musical theater class in the music department run by Alan Gilbert. And in that class were John Rubinstein, oh my, Judy Kaye, myself, and several people who had gone on. And we really had a wonderful time for 2 hours on Saturday mornings. That's where I really lived there. But we were kind of outcasts of the theater arts department. Not really, but, you know, we were in the music department. And somehow, I think in my sophomore, junior year, Johnny wrote a great piece called The Short and Turbulent Reign of Roger Ginsburg, which was wonderful. And I got into that as an actor-singer. And it was a bit of a political piece, and Gary Gardner, who was a professor, ended up taking over the principal role that Johnny was going to do. And then John said, I can't do it, and keep writing and making all the music happen. So it was quite a stellar time, because it was also a political time. I graduated in 69. The, you know, Make Love, Not War movement happened to be coming about, which was a wonderful poster by Sister Corita Kent, who was at my high school, at the college at my high school. I went to Immaculate Heart. And
I'm going to interrupt. And my mother is a graduate of Immaculate Heart College. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Small world.
That was a great school. Yeah. In high school, I directed and produced Winnie the Pooh. And in college, I was just, the first 2 years, my dad said, you know, do the requirements, get through, and then your junior and senior year, you get to do everything you want to be working on. And I didn't know what I wanted to work on, really, until my sophomore year. So, but it was a wonderful group of people that were in my class, and there were a lot of new plays being written, but there was also a sense of doing stuff that that was important. I think my junior year, we did Murat Saad. Mm-hmm. There's a musical called Johnny Johnson, which is a interesting, really fascinating musical that is not well known. Judy Kaye and I did the song that the Statue of Liberty sings.
Wow.
Together, and that was really quite wonderful. So there were very interesting choices that were being made, but as I said, what I what's amusing to me now is that the film department consisted of like two trailers in the back. Yes, yes.
Well, in many ways, that reflects the changes that have happened in Los Angeles as well. When you and I both got out of college, L.A. was really, really hopping. So much, though, that I remember there was a Time magazine article in 1981 that came out describing how exciting that L.A. was like the center of the universe as far as new plays and exciting theater. And now it's like a parking lot with a lot of empty spaces.
Yeah, it's been an interesting time that we've lived through, truly. I remember there were like no really good restaurants. On La Cienega, there were about three that you went to, and now there's gazillions of Korean, Latino, all these confluences of flavors and so forth. But I remember my dad saying one time, that's a big weekend. There was a soccer game. There was a football game. There was, you know, a baseball game. This was in the fall. You know, the Dodgers had arrived. The stadium was up. And I said, well, what about the theater? What's going on for concerts? And then soon after, you know, after that time, Dorothy Chandler went up. And so there was a kind of a base. You know, Gordon Davidson came in with some wonderful, extraordinary work at the Mark Taper Forum. And then there was the Amundsen that traditionally did kind of road shows and brought them in, but it was very much changing, and now we've had a very difficult time for small theaters because of COVID. But little by little, there's a lot coming back, and the last four or five plays that I've seen locally have been really quite excellent, really good. And then, of course, I got to do Death of a Salesman this last year, so I'm really pleased with that. It was done at place called Casa 0101 in East LA, Boyle Heights area, primarily a Latino cast, and it kind of worked perfectly in East LA because that's where when Arthur Miller wrote it, he was in Brooklyn, and the same kind of a working class kind of a neighborhood, and kids came, parents came who had heard of the play, kind of maybe read it or a chapter, an act of it, but never saw the whole thing put up. So it was, you know, it was like a 3-hour play, but people stayed through it, and it went well, went really well.
Well, and just the location of that theater, can you have imagined back in the 80s or 70s or even the, you know, 90s that there would be a professional small theater in Boyle Heights?
Now, Josefina Lopez did a good thing. She was in her 20s when she wrote Real Women Have Curves. And it went to, it was a stage play first, I believe, and then went to film, did really well. And she was writing, and, you know, her name came up on the radar for film and television, and a lot of, you know, good progressive ideas were abounding at the time. And she took the money, and she said, I'm going to build a theater in East L.A., and I'm going to teach the next generation, and that's what she has done. Emmanuel Delage is now in charge of the theater, but they're still keeping their acting classes, directing classes, and she was a great promoter of the painter arts. He has wonderful pieces up on the wall that are for sale, and the stage itself is a wonderful space. That's not always true. Some spaces are more inviting than others to the actor. That's a really good space to be on stage and deliver a monologue or do a scene. It's quite, you know, embracing.
Well, and there was, again, if you're talking about LA's theater scene, there really was a renaissance of, hey, it's almost, you know, Mickey and Judy, let's put on a show. But it was like, let's find a theater space and start a theater. I mean, I did that myself, which I have to say, I am so grateful that I am no longer in charge, but I am very proud of the Theater of Notes still exists. And there's something about that is just, it's like a legacy, you know.
It is. It's like your baby. Yeah. I spent a lot of time similarly at the Los Angeles Actors Theater, which was on Western and Santa Monica, and then moved downtown to become LATC. And
which we should say was part of downtown's renaissance. It was in an old bank building it's a gorgeous space. It's funky as heck, but boy, is it a beautiful space.
No, it's a wonderful space. And Bill Bushnell, when he started, it had Monday Night Labs. And there were like There was the Latino lab, there was the Shakespeare lab, there was the director's lab, women's director's lab, which was really important. And everyone usually took a break at about between eight and nine. That lobby was one of the best networking places in the city. To be there was really terrific. And I've also been fortunate to be a member over at Bilingual Foundation for the Arts. When I first came back from New York, I couldn't find a place to really like have a community. And, you know, I did plays over there in English and Spanish, and they were just, it was a haven for me. I have been a member of the Open Fist Theater, and that's a really good space, by the way, as well as the Actors Gang. So I've been very, very fortunate to be around town doing, you know, keeping my theater chops up, if you will. And then when something was right in film and television, you know, it was kind of ready because you need the experience of working on a role to be able to do it well.
Well, you know, things change, but things don't change. But I think I can't imagine, I know how hard it is as an actor. I was an actor for 10 years, but how hard it is to get work. And in those days particularly, how hard was it as a Latina actress to find roles?
You know, it's a combo kind of a thing. In film and television, I went to New York to study, came back out, and all the roles were what I call the mother or whore syndrome. That is, they were all somebody who was either a maid, I can't tell you how many maids I did, you know, or a prostitute for like a good time, more than 10 years. So I needed to feed my desire to keep growing by doing plays. There were certain theaters that I was more right for than others. Bilingual was one of them, of course, and Bill Bushnell at LH Actors Theater was another place. But it was hard to get roles that helped you expand. I joined a group called the Classical Theater Lab at one point in the 90s because I thought, I have to get used to being a queen, somebody in power, not someone who is, you know, at the bottom of the food chain. And I tried to align myself with new plays, hoping that I could be a part of the next wonderful playwright's group of actors that he or she would choose from for their next play. And that sort of happened. I was invited up to Sundance Institute about 7 times, and I got to meet a lot of wonderful new playwrights and as well as terrific actors. It was really, you know, a wonderful time. You go up, unpack, and then you take with you pencils. You know, forget about where your purse is, and just go down and work with a new playwright. So it was like being in heaven.
Well, if you were able to turn back the clock and be a 20-year-old actress today, do you think you would have a series, a television series, something else? You know, would your life as an actor be different? Would the mediums be different?
Yes and no. There are more Latino projects coming out, and there are still many roles for men, fewer roles for women. It's always that way. But I was just looking at the paper today, and they made, I couldn't believe, about 15 recommendations for films that should be considered under Academy nomination. They were all Latino films from South America, Chile, Argentina, Central America, and elsewhere. So there's more opportunity for Latino actors and actresses than there ever was before. Also for, you know, for Latinx and for there's just the variety is unbelievable.
Before I let you go, a lot of younger actors, generations from now maybe, will be listening to this conversation. What is the best piece of advice you can share? I mean, because everybody else has the mother who goes, are you crazy? You want to be an actor? What do you say in response?
You know, it's beyond cliche to say follow your dream, but when I was a freshman or sophomore in college, I said to my father, I think I want to go into the arts, and is that okay with you? Because he had become a doctor, for God's sake, against all odds. And he stopped and he said to me, you know, everybody's got to work. And there's going to be good and bad days. But if you're doing something that you care about and are passionate about, the bad days won't be so bad. So he was fine with me getting into the arts. So that's what I would say is that, you know, just make sure, Sandy Meisner would say, if there's something else that you think you might be happy doing, you should probably do that. Because this is a very hard, hard road. A lot of disappointment, a lot of, you know, things happen that are hard, difficult to deal with, and you need a lot of support from your family, your best friends. You shouldn't enter it thinking, oh, this is going to be fun. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of particular kind of work. But if but I would say if you really believe that you've got something, I'm working on Mama Rose from Gypsy, and she says, some people got it. Some people can't even give it away. This people's got it, and this person's going to spread it around. You either have it or you've had it.